First of all, there was a conflict with social justice having a TEOL today, I think. And so some people are missing this. We're recording it. But I do want to stress how important it is that everybody come to the Taking Ownership meeting, which is our next meeting, which I can't even tell you when it is, but some of you probably know better than me. So that's number one. Number two, not relevant for the PCJE students, but for everybody else, the good news is that the price for the Poland trip just went down because we have 25 people. So it's now going to be, I think, $810 plus airfare, which is I'm very, very happy about because it's wonderful. Okay. So what we're going to do today is we're going to, we talked previously about 900 years of Polish Jewish history, right? And what we're going to do today is talk about the interwar period. And I'd like, in fact, at 2:15 for somebody to stop me. Okay? At 2:15, please stop me, because at 2:15, I'd like to show you a 12-minute thing from YouTube. That is actually more about contemporary Polish Jewry, but I want to work that into. Okay? Okay, so Poland in the interwar years. 1918, World War I ends. 1939, World War II begins. Hence the interwar years. So, first of all, is there anybody here who's in? Doug, you're in my class. And Joe, you're in my class. And Elisa, you're in my class. So, a lot of what I'm going to say is going to be repetitious. If you want to, you know, get up and leave, feel free to do that. Although, if you can come back at 2:15, I think, you know, you might want to see the YouTube. Okay? Kasia, you're also in my class. Okay, so feel the same way. Don't be shy. So, hopefully everybody here remembers from that 900 years that Poland was partitioned, right? Austria, Prussia and Russia each divided Poland in the 1770s and then later again twice in the 1790s. And as a result of that, there was no independent Poland on the map from 1795 to 1918. I'm welcoming Rachel, who will be joining us on the trip. From 1795 to 1918. Okay? There's no independent. There are Polish people. They're speaking Polish. They identify ethnically as Polish. But there is no independent country. There is actually, if you look at a map from, let's say, 1850, you'll actually see something called the Kingdom of Poland. But it wasn't an independent state. It was the King of Poland was the Tsar of Russia. Got it? So it was just like. So the Poles, by the way, rose up in revolt a couple of times to try to achieve their independence. They failed. But World War I changes everything. Just like World War I changes so much in the world, and I think that most of us don't have a full appreciation for that. World War I was a game changer. It brought about the fall of the Tsar and the Bolshevik Revolution and the age of communism, which between communist revolutions and the Cold War dominated most of the 20th century. It was also the beginning of the League of Nations and an attempt to have some kind of international body, which we call today the UN, to try to make it the war to end all wars, okay? Because World War I was so horrific. The estimates are tens of millions of people who were killed more than any other conflict that we know about in human history up until that point. It also marked the end of royal regimes, the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the division into many smaller national states, the end of the Kaiser in Germany, and the beginning of a democratic Weimar Republic in Germany. I mean, it was really a very big game changer. And amongst those new nation states that are declared after World War I, again, remember Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, national self-determination, And by the way, the Balfour Declaration of 1917 is part of that movement as well of national self-determination. Poland is recreated on the map. So we now have an independent Poland. In fact, what's the Polish Independence Day? Does anybody know?
Armistice Day.
Exactly, November 11th. November 11th, Armistice Day, is Polish Independence Day. Right? Because that's when they became an independent country. There were Polish forces that were fighting along in World War I. In any case, it's not an easy transition. Because Poland immediately finds itself at war with the Bolshevik forces in Russia. And there's a war that will continue from 1918 until the early, 1919 really, into the early 1920s between what will become the Soviet Union and Poland. And this is part of a long history of enmity between Russia and Poland. A very long period of enmity. The partitions were part of that history where Russia took all of eastern Poland for itself and tried to Russify Poland in different ways. It goes back further than that, but I'm not going to go further than that. And looking forward, the events of World War II in 1939, September 1st, 1931, Germany invades Poland from the west. Here's a very accurate map of Poland. Okay? Here's Germany. Here's the USSR. Okay? Soviet Union. Germany invades on September 1st, 1939. The Soviet Union invades shortly thereafter from the east, according to a secret agreement that the Germans, the Nazis, and the Soviets made in August 1939.
Molotov-Ribbentrop.
That's right, Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which said, by the way, it sounded great to the world. It said Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, two bitter ideological enemies at the opposite ends of the political spectrum, the far right and the far left, who had fought a proxy war in Spain, the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, is essentially between the Nazis and fascists on the one hand, and between liberal and Soviet forces on the other hand. These two countries in August 1939 announced a non-aggression pact. We will not attack each other for the next 10 years. Well, it sounds wonderful, world peace. What could be better? But there was a secret clause. The secret clause was, the Nazis are going to invade on September 1st. The Soviets are going to invade shortly thereafter, and they are going to partition Poland again. The Nazis are going to take Western Poland. The Soviets are going to take Eastern Poland. No more Poland on the map again. Okay? Now, looking even farther forward, we're going to digress for a moment. Looking farther forward, talking about Polish-Soviet or Polish-Russian enmity, well, when the Soviet Union will liberate Poland from the Nazi occupation, okay, the Soviet forces will not leave this part of Poland. At the end of the war, Eastern Poland is occupied by the Soviet army, and with the nod of the Western allies, the Americans and the British, this will become part of the Soviet Union. Poland will be compensated because Germany lost the war, and so the Polish boundary is going to move a couple of hundred miles west. And this will be the new Poland.
With German speakers.
Yes, oh boy, German speakers, most of whom are forcibly expelled from their homes.
Right.
Millions of German speakers. And so from 1945 until today, this is the new Polish, these are the new Polish borders. The Polish borders essentially just moved westwards. The Soviets took the eastern part of what the Poles call historic Poland. Not only that, but the Soviets are going to impose communism on Poland until 1989. A very brutal communism. And so there is no love lost between the Poles and the Russians. And this is a theme that comes back today very, very much. Some of you may remember, I think it was about 7, 8 years ago, the top officials of the Polish government, including the president of Poland, including the head of the chief of staff of their army, and many of the leaders of the Polish government were invited to a special ceremony in the Soviet Union to commemorate the Katyn massacre. What was the Katyn massacre? In 1941, I think it was 1941, maybe it was 1940, the Soviets massacred a few thousand officers of the Polish army. Remember, the Soviets had occupied Eastern Poland. They captured Polish army prisoners. They took most of the officers, murdered thousands of them in the Katyn forest. They blamed it on the Germans, but it was the Soviets. We know it was the Soviets. So they invited members of the Polish government to come to a special memorial commemoration. Maybe it was 2010 or 11. And they invited them to come, and guess what? The plane that the Polish president and these officials were on crashed.
Yeah.
The president was killed, the head of the armed forces were killed, most of the leadership of Poland died in that crash. If you ask a Pole today, they will tell you that it was just a continuation of this struggle, and that it was not an accident that the plane crashed. Poland today is a very, very strong partner in NATO. They are deathly afraid of Putin and the Soviets. And I'm forgetting the name of the book. There's this book that predicts the next 100 years. It's actually intelligently written. But of course, who knows about prediction? But one of the predictions is that this is going that the Soviet Union is going to invade Poland sometime in the next few decades. And this is something the Poles are deathly afraid of. Okay? So we've digressed a little bit, but nonetheless, this is, I think, important for us to understand in terms of Poland today. Let's go back to the interwar years. So Polish state is recreated, and when it's recreated, again, it's along these borders. And what's interesting is that this Polish state is actually not so Polish. Meaning about a third of the population of this reconstituted Polish state are people who don't identify as Poles. So for example, there are lots of Lithuanians. There are lots of Ukrainians. And there are lots of Jews. They make up about a third of the population.
Jews are all three of those groups?
All three together. The Jews make up about 10%, and the Ukrainians and Lithuanians make up about 23% of the Polish population. So Poland, on the one hand, Poland is a multicultural country, which, by the way, historically it was. And today, there is a certain nostalgia in Poland for those days when Poland was multicultural. But in 1918, and 1920, and 1930, when this reconstituted Polish state has come back into existence, the dream of Polish nationalists, for them there's a feeling that these minorities are sort of in the way of their dream of Polish nationalism. And these minorities actually sense that their rights might be violated in the face of Polish nationalism, even though the Treaty at Versailles, which was aware of this problem in Poland and elsewhere, said these new states have to respect minority rights. And these three minorities get together in the Polish Sejm, the Polish parliament, and form what they call the Minorities Bloc. This Minorities Bloc actually is quite powerful in the Polish Sejm, because after all, they represent about a third of the seats. And you know, the Poles themselves voted along a spectrum. There were right-wing parties, there were left-wing parties, there were centrist parties. The Minorities Bloc often held the, how do we say, Lashon HaMaznayim, the balance in terms of many important votes in the Polish parliament. Is this a good thing or a bad thing for the Jews, for the minorities?
Gone
for gone. It's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it allows them to at least legally often protect their rights. On the other hand, it causes resentment. Right? If I can compare it, Lahavdil, to the position of the Haredim in the Knesset, right? On the one hand, it benefits them because they are powerful beyond their numbers, because they are often the key to forming a coalition. On the other hand, it causes resentment on the part of the others who say, why do you have such outsized power? So immediately you could see that we have some issues to deal with here. And the rising Polish nationalism in particular is going to have an impact on the Jews, and that's really our focus. So Poland in this period, we estimate has about 3.3 million Jews. By far the largest Jewish community anywhere in the world except for the United States. We had said before, when we did the 900 years, that Poland had the largest Jewish population in the world for hundreds of years, probably from about 1500 to about 1900. By 1918, the immigration to America had already made America the largest Jewish community in the world. But 3.3 million was far, far more than any other country aside from the United States in terms of the number of Jews. Not only that, Polish Jewry accounted for 10% of Polish total population. 10% of the country. Now that is so much more than any other diaspora that we know of. I mean, American Jewry is about 2%. At its height, it was about 4.7%. If you look at England or Canada's Jewish population, it's less than 1% of the total population. 10% of the population was Jewish. Moreover, the population in the cities was much more than 10%. And we know the cities are, of course, the center of economic development, of social change, of political power, and there, the Jews are much more than 10%. For example, in Warsaw, as we said in our last talk, Jews were about a third of the population of Warsaw. That's more than the Jewish percentage in New York at its height. And Lodz, the second largest city in Poland, also about a third Jewish. Lublin, about 35% Jewish. Krakow, about a quarter Jewish, which is roughly what New York was. But then when you go to the medium-sized towns, Bialystok was 50% Jewish. And the smaller shtetlach, the smaller market towns, which are also urban centers, but smaller. Cities like, well, another medium-sized city would be Tarnów, which we will hopefully visit, was also 50% Jewish. But the smaller cities, my parents' hometown of Brody, was two-thirds Jewish. Some of these shtetlach were 80% Jewish. And if there were 10,000 inhabitants, 8,000 of them were Jews. So the Jewish role in culture, economy, politics, social developments, is going to be far in excess of 10% of the population. Interestingly enough, most of the Jews are not located in Western Poland, but rather in Central and Eastern Poland. Only about 10% of Polish Jewry was in the West. About 90% was in the center and the east of Poland. And that's where we're going to be focusing our visit as well. Language. The 1921 Polish census asked a question, first of all, of religion. And because of that, we can say something about the Jews who were part of the Polish national census in 1921. So of those people who marked Judaism as a religion, and there might have been some Jews at that point who were assimilated enough that they might not have, but the vast majority of Polish Jews probably would have checked off Jewish as religion. So when they ask, what is your mother tongue? Your mother tongue. 80% of them said Yiddish. 8% said Hebrew. 12% said Polish.
What?
80% said
when?
Yiddish. When? 1921.
So the Hebrew was not a result of Zionism?
Ah. So, most historians believe that the 8% who said Hebrew, some were actually speaking Hebrew at home, and others were made as an ideological statement, a Zionist statement, and others may not really have been have had Hebrew spoken to them, but were making an ideological statement nonetheless. That's my mother tongue, even if it wasn't true.
But meaning that you think some people had actually been speaking Hebrew at home for generations?
Not for generations.
Okay.
Generation.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, so all as a result.
Yes. Yes. So that's the 8%. But what do you make of these numbers? What do you think of these numbers? What does it tell you? What doesn't it tell you? Joe?
I mean, when the population is diverse in the way you described, it doesn't say much to me, because I would be almost certain that of the 80% that said Yiddish, if you ask them what their second language was, first and second language, I'm sure that almost all of them would have said Polish. So I think that them saying Yiddish is also perhaps a marker of identity, rather than saying Polish. Like maybe the most urbane one said Polish first and then something else. But though the majority of them felt connected enough to their Jewish identity to say primarily Yiddish. And if you ask them, I'm sure they also spoke Polish, and probably maybe some Hebrew, maybe some Russian, maybe some German. You know, certainly an international cosmopolitan environment like what you described, I don't expect many monolingual Jews.
Okay, but again, the question was, what's your mother tongue, right?
Right.
And now, you're saying that had a question been asked, what's your second language, then many of them might have said Polish. I disagree with one point, though. Remember that until 1918, there's no Poland on the map. So where are these Jews now living in Poland? Where are they living up until 1918? The ones in the south, what we call Galicia, that we'll be visiting, these Jews are part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So what language would they probably know as a second language?
German.
The ones here, Prussia and then Germany. What's their second language?
German.
And the ones here are living under Soviet rule.
Russian.
So many of them might have spoken Polish, but many of them, their second language might have been German or Russian. Okay?
Given that the boundaries moved so much, though, wouldn't you more so expect them to speak the language of their neighbors rather than the language of their ruling power?
Well, remember, 1795 to 1918, so you've got a few generations living under a certain government. But yes, they may have spoken the language of neighbors. We know that many Poles spoke Yiddish. Because if you lived in a shtetl, and most of the people around you were speaking Yiddish, so actually, you probably knew Yiddish. And the same was probably true in reverse. So yes, what else would you say about these numbers? Yes, Alex.
I wanted to ask clarifying question. Do we know what language was mandated to be taught in schools, or if there was one?
It depends where they were. In other words, in the new state of Poland, Polish is going to be the language taught. And the 1921 numbers were very different from, let's say, 1941. When there wasn't a census taken because they were occupied by the Nazis, but no doubt, the numbers would be very different because the majority of Polish Jews would be going to Polish public schools in the interwar period. Even though there are Jewish schools, there are Jewish all-day schools, religious, secular, Hebrew, Yiddishist, but nonetheless, the majority of Jews in Poland are going in the interwar years to Polish public schools. And in fact, Emanuel Ringelblum, who we'll talk about much more later on, Emanuel Ringelblum writes in the Warsaw Ghetto that, of course, conditions are terrible. One of the slivers of hope that he has is that it'll bring about a revival of Yiddish, because so many more Polish Jews are speaking Polish than Yiddish. He's hoping that at least in the ghetto, Yiddish will have somewhat of a revival. Okay? But again, I want to come back to 1921. 80% say Yiddish, 8% say Hebrew, 12% say Polish was their mother tongue. Yes, Mr. Branson.
That idea, just based on the fact that Poland was recently reunified, and you know, there were people who maybe were ethnically Lithuanian, if that's such a thing, I don't really know.
Yep.
But like, what does that mean in terms of like, for that minority group, their cultural cohesion? And I think it means that if you have this newly reunified place and you have this minority that is so strongly identified with this piece that is in contrast to the rest of the country in so many different ways, both religiously and linguistically, I think
mm-hmm.
that's going to be leveraged as a tool against that community, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would say that they're much more, if not like, not a Haredi religion, but they're much more engaged with the tradition. Like, even when you say, like, toilet paper, you say, like, was it like Esher Yitzhar Piper or something like that? You do it just by saying toilet paper, you're invoking a bracha. And so I think they're much more engaged with traditional Judaism.
I agree, but I have a caveat here. First, let me talk about how I agree. 88% of Polish Jews have grown up with the Jewish language as their mother tongue, at least according to the census. Right? Now, the mother tongue you have is such an important part of our cultural identity. Such an important part. Witness, I think everybody in this room, even though our Jewish identities might be very strong, how is it for us to be studying Jewish texts in what is for us a second language? What difficulties does that present? How much are we not at home? And the people in this room, of course, represent people who actually are interested in those things. How much of English-speaking Jewry is put off by the fact that it's a foreign language? Tarte mashma, not just in language, but language being just the tip of the iceberg. So now, we all know that if you want to know French culture deeply, you can't just read in translation. If you can't read Molière in the original, something's lost. There's a barrier. Right? So now, how Jewish was this community that 88% of them are growing up with a Jewish language as their mother tongue?
A Jewish language, but that's not the language of the Torah or the Talmud or like most like shuvas and like significant pieces of Machshavei Yisrael throughout the centuries. So
I think it's much more a cultural thing than a religious
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I like raising kids who are English speakers at home in Israel now. Like, I see how they play with other kids and how the fact that they know English connects them, some kids who either don't speak Hebrew or they play differently with the kids with whom they speak Hebrew. Like, and then, so you have this population spread across the country who somehow feel like they have this commonality amongst themselves that they don't share with, I mean, you said some Poles spoke Yiddish, but I assume that was, I don't know. But for the most part, if you're a Pole walking down the street and you hear Yiddish, these are people in my country speaking another language different than mine that I don't understand, that you can travel from the north to the south and Jews can speak to each other, but I can't speak to them. I imagine the implications are...
It sets you apart.
Yeah.
It sets you apart. There's no question, and I am speaking only on a cultural level. The religious example I gave was actually, you know, I was referring to that here, to this group, just for us to imagine what it means when you, I mean, it's one of the advantages, by the way, of our children growing up in Israel. They have greater access to these sources because it's their first language, or at least their close second language in some of our cases. So where I disagree, and here I agree with Mimi, is that this doesn't necessarily mean they are religious. It doesn't mean they're religious. In fact, there are tremendous changes taking place in the Polish Jewish population in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, where more and more of them are moving away from religious observance. But culturally, they're still very much tied to Jewish culture, because almost 90% of them have been raised with the Jewish language. Yiddish was the language of Jewish life in Poland. Okay? And it's true, while many of them were not, the vast majority of them were not Talmidei Chachamim, the vast majority of them are not going to yeshiva, they have a strong tie to this group and to this culture. Just as an example, Yiddish theater. Yiddish theater is so popular in Poland. In 1937, 500,000 tickets are sold in 1 year to the Yiddish theater in Warsaw alone. The Yiddish film industry is developing at this time. The Yiddish film industry is obviously at a very young age, but there are Yiddish films being produced. So in terms of, now again, these are things that are not necessarily going to appeal to the Haredi portion of Polish Jewry, but they reflect the culture of Polish Jewry at the time. But I want to look at it the other side too. 12% of Polish Jews say Polish is their mother tongue. Now let's think for a minute. What does it mean mother tongue in 1921? They're not interviewing five-year-olds. They're interviewing adults. So let's say the adult is 40 years old. That means that person was born in 1881. In 1881, this person is saying, I grew up in a Polish-speaking home, if they're 40. If they're 30, in 1891. This indicates to us that there is already a process of acculturation going on. And that process, as I mentioned just before about the Polish public schools and Polish language, is only going to increase during this period of Polish independence, 1918 to 1939. So on the one hand, we have a community very steeped in Jewish culture. On the other hand, we have a community that is increasingly acculturated to Polish culture and is moving away from religious observance, especially amongst the young in large numbers. Okay, there's one more census I want to quote, and that's the census of 1931. Sorry, that was 1931. Everything I said to you before is 1931. 1921. The 1921 Polish census asked for your religion, and that asked a very strange question. They said, what is your nationality? Well, you would think in a national census, who needs to ask what's your nationality? I mean, if you're living in America, taking an American census, I doubt they ask, what is your nationality? It's Barur, it's American.
Not in
Dual citizenship.
And also permanent residents and immigrants.
And do you think they ask that question?
They do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They really?
Do. Yeah, take the census.
They ask citizenship or do they ask nationality?
They have the citizenship question was struck down, but nationality or national identity.
Really? I stand corrected.
It's relatively recent.
I stand corrected. It's recent.
Yeah, I
remember. Yes, okay. So again, it's a product of multiculturalism, et cetera.
Yeah.
So here, why are they asking, what is your nationality? Because remember, Poland's a newly created state. And people have been living under other governments. People belong to different ethnic groups, the Lithuanians, the Ukrainians. And so when they ask the Jews that question, 70% of those who said religion is Jewish, 70% said our nationality is Jewish.
Was it like a, was it a open-ended question? Was it a fill-in-the-bubble? Was it a multiple choice? Like because those questions are very much shaped by how people are able to respond.
I do not know the answer. I do not know the answer to that. But what do you make of that?
You said 1931.
This is 1921. So it's 3 years after Poland's declared independence. 70% say my nationality is Jewish. Whether answering from a multiple choice or whether answering in a blank, I think that's a pretty overwhelming majority of people who are making a very strong statement about where their national aspirations are. And in fact, it represents two of the three major Polish political Jewish movements of the interwar years. Because there were three major political parties amongst the Jews, or let's say political movements to be more correct. One was the Bund. The second were the Zionists, Lemineihem, of different stripes. And the third was Agudat Yisrael. These two identified as Jewish nationalist movements. This one, Yiddishist and socialist revolutionary, and this one, Hebrew and advocating Aliyah and the establishment of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. These are both Jewish national organizations. And roughly, and here I'm oversimplifying because the election results in different places and different times varied, but in a very rough, oversimplified way, each one of these represented about a third of Polish Jewry. So if we say, again, very roughly, this is two-thirds, it roughly corresponds to the 70% who said, my nationality is Jewish. Either I am a Bundist, meaning the Bund was founded in 1897 in Vilna. It's a Jewish workers' organization. They believe in creating a socialist revolution in Poland in which the Jews will have cultural autonomy. And Yiddish will be the basis of that cultural autonomy. They're anti-religious. They're anti-Zionist. For them, it was ideal to hold a dinner dance right across the street from a shul on Kol Nidre night. So this is the Bund. They were a very powerful force. They protected Jewish workers in the factories. They organized unions and strikes. They organized self-defense against pogromists. The Zionists, again, anywhere from the right-wing Zionists, followers of Jabotinsky, to the socialist Zionists, and everything in between, are also Jewish nationalists. Agudat Yisrael, maybe ironically to some of us, this is the Haredi party that's founded in 1912.
Are these parties in the Polish government?
Yes, all of these have representatives in the Sejm, in the Polish parliament. Okay, and they also run in Jewish communal elections. So we have two kinds of statistics to look at. Agudat Yisrael is founded in 1912 by the Gera Rebbe, who's the most powerful Hasidic Rebbe in Poland. The Polish Catholics called him the Jewish Pope, and the Chafetz Chaim, Rav Yisrael Kagan, who is the leader of the Lithuanian Yeshivish Misnagdish faction. The two of them come together in 1912 and say, we need to form a movement to protect Torah against modernity. What does that tell us?
There's already a fight between Torah, and modernity.
Modernity is already making inroads into Jewish religious life in 1912.
And the magnitude of their fear to get the leader of Misnagdish Jewry and one of the leaders of Hasidic Jewry together to say we need to put our difference to the side is like not a small thing.
True, although by 1912 the differences between Hasidim and Misnagdim, at least the rivalry between them, is more of a rivalry and less of antagonism. There's more, but clearly one of the reasons they're brought together is the common enemy. The common enemy is modernity. The common enemy is Haskalah. So when they come together, they are actually, to me, it's a remarkable movement because on the one hand, they want to protect tradition. On the other hand, they're going to use modern methods to protect tradition. They're going to form a political party. They're going to use newspapers. They're going to have youth movements and summer camps, just like the secular movements of the Bundists and the Zionists. And most of all, most radical of all, will be when they endorse and promote the Beis Yaakov school system to teach women Torah in the Haredi community. Sara Schneerer, a person about whom we'll speak in Poland. Sara Schneerer founds the first Beis Yaakov in 1917 in Krakow. She's a remarkable woman, a real pioneer, although some people like to make believe that she was actually the first religious school for women. It's not true. She is the pioneer in the Haredi world in Poland, but there were already Jewish schools for women in Germany. How did she become aware of that? In World War I, like many Jews in Galicia, she fled to Vienna, and in Vienna she sees, wow, there are religious educated Haredi women. How did they get that education? From religious schools for women that were established in Germany under the influence of Samson Raphael Hirsch in the mid-19th century. So it's not the first religious school, but amongst Haredim in Eastern Europe, this is something new. Initially, the leaders of Agudat Yisrael are not so excited about this idea, teaching Torah to women. Ultimately, when the idea starts to grow, they come behind it, they help spread it. By 1939, there are hundreds of Beis Yaakov schools in Poland and elsewhere. And there is nothing more modern than education for women. Nothing represents modernity more than education for women. And the fact that Agudat Yisrael ultimately endorses this reflects the fact that they are a movement trying to protect traditional values, but using modern means. Okay. We didn't get through everything, but we did get through most things. We're gonna stop here. And